Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. We've all seen the pictures and heard the stories about climate change, from polar bears on thin ice to tropic islands threatened with extinction to wild extremes in weather. While some deny there is a threat, the overwhelming science is that it is indeed happening and that the threat is huge. A new UN report verifies this. But what now, and how will climate change impact us in the Midwest? I'm Don Marsh. That's our subject on today's program. Joining me in studio, Jack Fishman, professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at St. Louis University. He is also the director of SLU's Center for Environmental Sciences. Brian Etling lives in St. Louis, but is a seasonal park ranger at Crater Lake National Park in Oregon. He lectures and teaches on climate change and has a first-person perspective. Larry Lazar is a businessman and, along with Brian Etling, is co-founder of Climate Reality St. Louis, an organization founded nationally by former Vice President Gore, dedicated to inspiring action to deal with climate change. Lazar is a one-time climate change skeptic. So let's start there. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Larry, let me begin with that. What changed your mind about all of this?
Well, a dose of reality. I was hit over the head big time. And I'm very fortunate in that I have a brother-in-law that is a scientist, and he's a wildlife biologist. He's in Alaska, the Kenai Peninsula. And I took my family to see him back in, I think, 2006, I believe it was. And one of the things you do in Alaska is tour the glaciers when you're there. And when you see the kind of the before and after pictures there, and when you talk to the park rangers and read the information about why they're doing what they're doing, and they're doing it around the world, you get hit with reality. And then, I realized then that what I've been reading in my sources of information at that time was just wrong. So I decided just to really dig in on my own. I read dozens of books, hundreds of papers and articles, and attended conferences and whatnot, and became very, very involved. And through that understanding is kind of why I speak out now so much, because I feel obligated based on what I learned through that experience.
Brian, you as a seasonal park ranger have a different perspective on this. You've actually seen things happen as a result of climate change.
Yes. Well, first I want to say that how happy I was that Larry was actually influenced by park rangers. So I make sure my park ranger friends get to hear that part. But yes, I've been working at Crater Lake National Park for the past 22 years in the summertime. And in the wintertime, I worked in Everglades National Park in Florida. And some of my friends were talking about sea level rise there. The sea level rose 8 inches in Florida in the 20th century, and that was four times more than it had in previous century. So some of the natural barriers had been overrun, and Everglades itself, a third of the park is brackish water, mixture of fresh water and salt water. So that change had kind of shifted some of the wildlife patterns, shifted some of the ecosystems there. So I was reading up on it. But the other factor of this, too, is that people expect park rangers to know everything. So park visitors coming to the park from St. Louis and elsewhere were asking me about this global warming thing. So I started reading up on it, and so that's why I got really concerned and started spending my winters in St. Louis. Crater Lake, where I spend my summers, that's one of the snowiest areas in the United States. It gets an average, a total accumulation of 44 feet of snow. And typically when I go back in May, and this year I'll be going back on May 5th, I typically see upwards of almost 10 feet of snow on the ground. Well, these last few years, I'm seeing less and less. They only have about half of their snowpack this winter. And so I'm noticing at Crater Lake, our winters are getting shorter, and I'm seeing more rain in May and September where I should be seeing snow. I typically see it snow up until Father's Day, but now mixed more into this is actually more rain. So I'm actually seeing this firsthand, and the wildlife in our national parks and elsewhere is responding to climate change.
But Jack Fishman, can't a lot of this be explained by the fact that weather is cyclic and that we've gone through periods before similar to this?
Well, of course, there is a cyclical nature to the weather. And we go into certain patterns, but what we're talking about with respect to climate is that you're seeing a shift to warmer temperatures on the decadal level as opposed to year-by-year variability. So what we saw in the summer of 2012, for example, may indeed be the norm the next 30 or 40 years, according to the models that are suggesting climate change is upon us.
Well, here is something that you've all heard many, many times, and that is we've just gone through a winter that most of us would like to forget. And I had on Facebook this morning, I announced that we were having this program today. And, of course, the first response I got was, look at the winter we just had. What is this global warming stuff? It's the coldest winter we've had in many a season.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the coldest winter in 25 years. But then if you look at the records previous to that, I mean, 25 years ago, 1989, this is the coldest winter since then. 1989 wasn't so abnormal compared to the many years before that. I was surprised, checking the records, how much colder it gets in the record book. We never broke a daily record this past winter, but it was just back to a situation that was more or less commonplace 25, 30 years ago.
Brian, and another response I had to this particular email mm-hmm. was that, we had a very cold winter, but in Australia, they had one of the hottest summers on record.
Yeah, the United States only makes up about 2% of the world's surface here, too. So it may be cold out your window, but the satellites are telling us something else. As a friend of mine, Scott Mandia, likes to say, is weather is what you see at your window. Climate is what you can see from a satellite. So when people say that to me, the first thing I like to respond with is Mark Twain. Mark Twain said 100 years ago, climate is what you expect, weather is what you get. And I also heard this wonderful analogy, too, that climate is the percentage of long johns versus shorts in your closet. So obviously, if you live in Alaska, you're going to have lots of long johns, maybe one pair of shorts. Florida, lots of shorts, maybe one pair of long johns. But weather is deciding whether you're going to wear shorts or long johns today. So the weather is shifting. So for some people, probably they're in their wardrobes in Alaska and elsewhere. They're shifting their closet because of climate change.
And Larry Lazar, Mark Twain also said, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. How do you respond to people who are deniers, if you will?
Well, let me just add on to what Brian talked about in Alaska and wearing long johns. They didn't wear long johns this winter in Alaska. My sister-in-law sent me pictures. He lives in Kenai Peninsula, and there's a lake that they ice skate on, Skylack Lake, near their home. And she could not ice skate this year for the first time since they've been up there in 22 years. It was late January. The temperature was 65 degrees in Alaska in late January. It was like 20 below here or something, very cold here. So the weather changes up there. They had the warmest January on record. The warmest winter on record in Alaska, and that kind of that's happening in Siberia right now as well. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was cold in eastern half of the United States, but crazy, crazy weather elsewhere. But you're responding to deniers on questions like that. You have to agree with them. Yes, it was cold in St. Louis, but not globally.
Yeah, but going back to what you said Don, about no one does anything about it. You look at how the field of atmospheric science and meteorology has progressed over the last half century or so. The weather forecasts now are just so much better than they were mm-hmm. 10, 20, 30 decades ago. When at one time, because of the lack of computer power, the lack of satellite observations, weather, when I was in graduate school in the 70s, forecasting was as much an art as a science. Now the art's pretty much gone, and what we used to call art, we now understand scientifically why it does happen. Well, fast forward now to the climate problem. That is an extremely more difficult problem than just forecasting the weather. You've got all sorts of variables, all sorts of ocean-atmosphere interaction that, quite frankly, we don't understand exactly how these processes work. And when you hear people talk about being skeptical of forecasts, it's because we don't understand those processes entirely. And yes, the models do not get everything right, but they get an awful lot right mm-hmm. as opposed to what they used to get right a few years ago. And we're going to keep on making these advances. Science is an iterative type progression. You don't find solutions overnight. It's going to take a while. And you have to sort of believe that with hundreds of scientists working on the problem that we're understanding it better. The conclusion of the report that came out last week is that indeed warming is here, and indeed it is more likely than ever believable before that it is a human-caused situation.
Well, let me just make reference to that report for those who may not be familiar with it. I'm reading here, a UN panel on climate change says major action is needed fast to limit global warming to acceptable levels. In its report, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, said the emissions grew more quickly between 2000 and 2010 than in each of the three previous decades and have to drop dramatically 40 to 70% by 2050. That, of course, just reinforces what you gentlemen are saying and what you're talking about.
But conversely, the temperature has not risen as quickly in the last 10 years as it had in a couple of decades before that. So these are what the skeptics are saying, that, yes, you're saying it's supposed to be warmer, but your models aren't right. Well, there are factors in the models that just aren't properly accounted for is the counter answer to that.
Mm-hmm. But there are, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, because so probably somebody will call in and say, well, I've heard that it has not warmed in the past 17 years. And what they're doing is what's called cherry picking. 1998 was really a hot year with an El Nino. And so they've taken that, but decade by decade, it is getting warmer. As a friend of mine likes to say that, saying it hasn't warmed in the past 17 years, that's like saying your car is broken down because it stopped at a stop sign. Mm-hmm. Or if you took a statistics class and said it hasn't warmed in the past 17 years, a statistic professor basically would flunk you because climate science works on periods of at least 30 to 100 years. So 17 years. So that's just a common response if somebody says it hasn't warmed. But so decade by decade, it's been getting warmer.
Well, you mentioned El Nino, and let's have Jack, our professor here, explain to the audience what El Nino is, a warming of the waters of the ocean, correct?
Yeah, basically, if you look at the Pacific Ocean and sort of treat it like a bathtub, you've got this constant sloshing going back and forth in this many thousand mile basin. And at times, the water is going to be warmer at one end than on the other. And when I was in graduate school, we didn't know that at all. But with the advent of satellite measurements and understanding much better satellite measurements and getting observations for the first time over these remote regions of the world, we understand that there are patterns that evolve insofar as warming and cooling on one side of the Pacific versus the other. And that is the El Nino phenomenon. It's really called the El Nino Southern Oscillation. It has two phases to it, the El Nino phase versus the La Nina phase, meaning that the western Pacific is colder than normal versus warmer than normal. So right now, we've been in a neutral pattern for El Nino for the last couple of years, but I just taught this last week, by the way. We are approaching what they think is an El Nino situation. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, they're predicting a relatively mild hurricane season.
Mild hurricane
right,
season.
Right.
Well, that is certainly good news. We have to take a break. Let's do that now. You just heard from Jack Fishman, who is professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at St. Louis University. He's with me in studio, as is Brian Ettling, who is a seasonal park ranger who lectures and teaches on climate change. Larry Lazar is also with us in studio, a businessman and organizer of Climate Reality St. Louis. He's a one-time climate change skeptic, and the organization Climate Reality St. Louis was co-founded with Brian Ettling. Have to take that break now. We'll come back. We'll certainly want your comments, too. You know the number, I hope, by now, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org if you like. You can also send us a tweet at STL on air. Back to continue our discussion on climate change in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation. The discussion topic today is climate change, and we'll get on with that in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri State Board of Education will consider the future of the Special Administrative Board for St. Louis Public Schools during its meeting today. The state-appointed board has overseen the district since it lost state accreditation in 2007. The three-member board's current authority ends in June. Newly confirmed Secretary of the Air Force Deborah Lee James will visit Scott Air Force Base this afternoon. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says he wants to show Secretary James why Scott is, quote, a crucial asset for both our armed forces and the Metro East region. And the Missouri Senate could resume debate on legislation today that would require women to wait up to 3 days before having abortions. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation on climate change. With me in studio is Larry Lazar, a businessman, organizer of Climate Reality St. Louis. He is a one-time climate change skeptic. Brian Ettling is a seasonal park ranger who lectures and teaches on climate change. He is co-founder of Climate Reality St. Louis. Also with us is Jack Fishman, professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at St. Louis University. I want to go to the phones early on because I think this first call will lead me to something else I wanted to get to. So let's bring in Matt calling from South County. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Go ahead, please.
Great. Yeah. So my question is this. There's a study that the University of California in Berkeley put out, and it was relating to the cattle industry and dairy and the amount of waste that cows produce. And I'm wondering if you guys have any information or thoughts on the process of the amount of beef and the amount of dairy people consume and the amount of waste that these cattle are putting into out into the system and emitting. So if you guys could talk about that, I'll hang up. Thanks.
Right. He's talking about the methane gas that cows emit. Jack, you want to take that?
Yeah. Methane has several sources, and actually the whole picture of methane release is much better understood now than it was. And indeed, what they call enteric fermentation, which is a process by which ruminants release gases to the atmosphere, is the dominant source. I am not familiar with what the story is that you're referring to about California, but it's all part of a natural cycle of the methane budget in the atmosphere. I'll be glad to look up the story and try to comment on particulars of it, but methane is a major component. With regard to other major factors regarding methane concentrations in the atmosphere, we're concerned about the permafrost in the northern latitudes melting that contain a lot of methane. And even fracking, we know that there's a large loss from fracking, and they're looking for a global signature as whether or not this is perturbing the natural methane cycle. But a lot of the methane that's released to the atmosphere is indeed man-made through cattle farming and rice production.
We need a quick primer here, and this is almost unfair of me to ask given the complexity of the subject, but can you give us a quick tutorial on what methane is doing to make our planet warmer?
Well, for a gas to act as what they call a greenhouse gas, it has to have more than one atom, okay? As you know, carbon dioxide is three atoms, and when the Earth emits radiation, it excites those bonds within those atoms and absorbs that radiation, then it will re-emit it back to Earth. That's the resultant greenhouse effect. Methane is a five-atom molecule, and the same process. Methane and the chlorofluorocarbons, we won't get into that right now, and carbon dioxide are primary greenhouse gases. But the most important greenhouse gas is water vapor. It's also three atoms, and it's a natural component. So that's part of the problem that science has is to try to distinguish.
Excuse me for interrupting, but what is happening? Okay, so we've got these gases floating around. What is happening to actually make it warmer and cause oceans to rise and islands to disappear and polar bears to sit on ice cubes?
Well, basically, yeah. Before I came here, I was at NASA, and one of the major projects was to understand something called the Earth Radiation Budget. And it's not a simple problem. So all the energy we receive to the Earth is from the sun. The Earth will absorb the radiation and then re-emit it back to the atmosphere, back out into space. But not all of it gets back out into space because of the presence of these various molecules. So as we increase the concentrations of these molecules, like methane, like carbon dioxide, that radiation that would normally go back out to space, for example, you see it at night. If you have clear skies, it gets much colder than if you have cloud cover. It's the water vapor in the atmosphere that's absorbing that radiation and re-emitting it, and that's a greenhouse gas. So the methane molecules, the carbon dioxide molecules, the artificially produced chlorofluorocarbons, which destroy the ozone layer, are all greenhouse gases. And these have all increased unnaturally because of human activity.
Okay, let me go to another news item here. The Heartland Institute, which I suppose you gentlemen are familiar with, says more than 30 scientists served as authors and reviewers for a new report, which it claims cites more than 1,000 peer-reviewed studies supporting the belief that climate change is not detrimental to the biosphere and claims that the human impact is small. Brian, you've heard about the Heartland Institute, have you not?
Definitely, because 2 years ago they were putting up billboards in Chicago using the likeness of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and Osama bin Laden, and saying that Osama bin Laden and Ted Kaczynski actually also accept climate change. And so they got a lot of bad press about that, and they lost a lot of their sponsors doing that too. And so, yeah, Heartland Institute, they're definitely on the fringes here, but they're basically just that 0.1%. And the thing is that, yeah, they'll find scientists, and Jack could probably answer this but much better than I could, but the scientists that they find are basically, they're not well cited by other scientists. Their work is not very well. It tends to be very shoddy, very incomplete. And so, yeah, they could probably, they can cherry pick a few studies here and there. But James Powell did a study over the past 20 years looking at all the scientific peer-reviewed papers, and over 99%, and this is like 14,000 papers, reaffirm that climate change is real, it is happening right now, and it's primarily, in this time period, caused by humans.
Larry, what am I trying to remember? Some emails that were well-publicized a year or two ago with regard to scientists kind of puffing this thing up for reasons that maybe you can explain.
Yeah, that's generally referred to as Climategate, I believe it's called,
right.
Where a number of actually several thousand emails were stolen out of a email server, I believe, in England. And those emails were kind of cherry-picked. And if you imagine if someone went through your emails over the past decade or so.
I don't even go through my emails.
you could find statements there that could be taken out of context, be misleading. And the reality is that there has been, I believe, at least six different independent reviews. O'Brien's telling me eight now.
Yeah, eight.
Eight different independent reviews clearing those scientists of any wrongdoing, and they've all been completely exonerated.
And Jack, Michael Crichton put out a book a couple of years ago. I've forgotten the name of it. But basically, he apparently had done a lot of research into this. And one of his bottom lines was he was a denier at the time. And basically said that it was scientists were basically puffing this whole thing up because it enabled them to seek and receive a lot more grant money as long as they kept this. I guess he was referring to it as a myth.
Yeah, I think I read that book, but I forgot it now. It wasn't the Andromeda strain, I know that.
No, it's not.
But no, scientists are basically very conservative people. And by nature, if you are a good scientist, you have to be skeptical. That's how the science progresses. You look at the data and you say, hey, this doesn't quite fit to what I think should be happening. And then you propose another way of looking at it, either through a numerical model or go out and collect some more data. And you say, well, you know, I've made my contribution because I found out why this isn't as it should be. So science is in general very incremental. Those gee whiz moments are very infrequent, but even when they first come about, the hypotheses that are sort of revolutionary. And I think about the famous paper in 1974 by Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland that talked about the depletion of the ozone layer because of the chlorofluorocarbons. A lot of people were skeptical of that, and many people within the decade after that paper was written found evidence that it wasn't, why the whole hypothesis was not true. But gradually the science came together, and gradually we realized that it was a true hypothesis. So science isn't dramatic. It's very tedious. It's incremental steps. Brian alluded to something like 10,000 scientific papers supporting global change. I wouldn't say that's necessarily true. What they are these papers are looking at are very, very small pieces of the climate puzzle and trying to understand them better, most of which leads to the belief that indeed climate change is a reality and it's caused by human impact.
We have a number of phone calls. I want to get to them, but I have one more question to get this on the table before we take the calls. How are we likely to be impacted if this whole process continues? Mm-hmm. How are we impacted in the Midwest? We don't have a coastline. We don't have glaciers. We don't have polar bears. We have none of these things, and yet we would be impacted as this process continues. Larry, how?
I would say there's two big things. One is all the things that we've seen in the past will just get worse. So droughts, floods, severe heat waves, things of that nature.
Storms
will be on steroids. So there's more energy in systems. So all those things happen at a greater rate or higher intensity. But the other thing to keep in mind, too, is we don't live in a bubble here in St. Louis. We're a system. We're a global system. So things that happen in South America or Africa, We can't grow coffee anymore, or the less coffee, or the price of coffee goes up. If there's droughts in Nebraska or Kansas or Iowa where our food production is limited, the cost of our grocery bill goes up. So there is no little bubble. We're all connected. So what happens anywhere affects all of us.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you're nodding. You're obviously right on board with all of this.
Oh, yeah. I was going to add that, you know, what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas with climate change. You know, that this is a global phenomenon, too, that we're certainly interconnected here. It certainly affects our food and our crops. And I like what Dr. Richard Somerville said about this. He says our elaborate infrastructure of dams and canals and water systems, our elaborate infrastructure won't work, or we're threatening it because it was designed for the climate that we had, not the one that we're going to have with climate change. So we're really kind of tinkering. You know, as Dr. Wallace Broker of Columbia University liked to say, too, that the climate system, if you look at the Earth's 4-billion-year history, it's an angry beast. And what we're doing right now by throwing all this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're basically poking it with sticks. We've got to be very careful what we're doing here.
Jack, the fact that, as Larry put it, storms would be on steroids here is interesting to me, and I'm sure to our listeners. Why would that happen? I mean, why would storms be more vicious?
Well, in simple terms, you're basically disrupting the heat balance of the atmosphere, so you have to have more vigorous heat exchange between the lower latitudes and the higher latitudes. In principle, that leads to more severe storms because the process has to be more intense to accomplish the purpose of what we view on Earth as everyday weather.
Let's go to the phones. A number of calls, as I say, and the questions are often better than my own. So let's start with Rick calling from Belleville. Go ahead, Rick. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I tend to fall on the side of believing that climate change is happening and that probably there's a human component to it. And, you know, when I find myself getting into arguments and debates with my friends who are skeptics, I sympathize with their skepticism because, you know, it's hard for a citizen to really have access to and be able to understand all the studies that are going on such a high level of scientific research. Mm-hmm. So my question is, you said earlier that there's many pieces to the puzzle. And what I would like to know is, can you point to something that would clarify how big of a piece of the puzzle human behavior is? And, you know, how can we differentiate from what we are doing as people and being bad stewards of our environment with, you know, just the normal, you know, ebb and flow of nature that, you know, gives us these heating and cooling cycles.
Rick, thank you so much for the call. Who'd like to take that? We're not doing the same thing that the cows are doing. Let's make that clear.
Now, I think you've asked the $64 question. That's an old radio show, I believe. But differentiating natural variability from human-induced perturbations to those natural cycles is really the challenge of the scientists. And I don't know how you really do it, but, you know, over 300 scientists, maybe a couple thousand even at this point, have contributed to the IPCC document. And they've spent their careers trying to figure this stuff out. And I know many of them. They're all good, hardworking people and have nothing to gain by being dishonest. So you sort of have to take what you see from these scientific results. Part of the problem is that you're seeing people hyping things or being more exaggerating things one way or the other a lot more than was actually written by the scientists themselves. So it's a difficult question that you ask, and there's no simple answer to it. Sorry to be so evasive.
But basically, fossil fuels are at the root of this particular evil. Is that not correct? And what's coming out of the smokestacks
yes.
and the automobile exhausts mm-hmm. are what is causing the problem.
Yeah, we've contributed, I think, 583 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere since the industrial age. So if carbon dioxide is a heat-trapping gas, and we know it is, we can measure that, and we can test it, you can't not have warming because of that 583 billion tons of mm-hmm. carbon.
If I can add something, too, I would really encourage our last caller to go on. There are great websites out there that will answer your questions. One is NASA's website. I think it's NASAClimate.gov, correct me if I have
that correct.
And there's also the one that folks that are really interested in learning about climate change is skepticalscience.com. www.scientificsense.com. It was started by an Australian, John Cook, and now thousands of scientists have contributed to this website. What they've gone is they actually have weighed out all the skeptical claims, and they will provide you the science to really answer your questions about what's happening with climate change. So I would recommend skepticalscience.com and just go on NASA's website. They have they do a wonderful job of explaining what's happening with climate change.
And one of the things you'll see in the NASA website is a chart of CO2 levels over 800,000 years, and you see there's ups and downs over those 800,000 years, but it's always been under 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide, under 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere until now, until recent last 120 years or so, and now we're over 400 parts per million now. And it's all happened since industrial age.
And we can trap that because particles are trapped in
ice. That's exactly right.
Let's take a quick call from Jeff. He's calling from Oxford, Ohio. Jeff, thanks for joining us long distance.
Hey, guys. Thanks for talking with us today. So you were just talking about how climate change is kind of a global problem. So right now we see that developed countries are pretty much the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases, probably as well as China. And we know we need to curb those emissions pretty fast. But third world countries, underdeveloped countries, as they develop, they're going to continue to emit gases, and their greenhouse gas production is going to increase. So my question is, how can they develop in a sustainable way so that they minimize their greenhouse gas production and don't end up quite like us in the States with ridiculously high per capita greenhouse gas emissions? Thank you.
All right, Jeff, thanks
by the way,
the
that is Jeff Lazar from Miami University. I recognize that voice.
Well, do you want to answer this question?
Oh, gee, well, one of the things I would say about that, too, and it's great, and I was like, wow, we've got listeners in from Ohio. I was really impressed there. I would say that we have to do what we can to invest in solar and invest in wind, and so third world countries, it becomes even a bigger priority for them. We got to help these countries leapfrog past our Victorian Industrial Revolution of using coal and using oil and helping them to transition more to clean energy. In many cases, they want to do that anyway because it helps them be more independent. And another one I want to address, because I'm sure it will come up here, is China itself. China is actually investing a lot more in renewables than we are. The latest statistics I saw was last year was $64 billion, as opposed to about, some cases, $54 billion in our case. European Union, even more than us. So we've got to get in this race with more renewables. Third world countries want to do it. They don't want to repeat our mistakes of having pollution here also. But one of the reasons why we need to do more, and hopefully we're going to cover solutions here today, we need to do more solutions so we can pollute less and have a cleaner planet, especially for Jeff.
I do want to add something else too. I was last month, I was invited to Johannesburg, South Africa to be part of the Climate Reality Project there. I helped train other Climate Reality presenters. And one night I had dinner with 15 people, and I was the only American in that group. There are people there from the Philippines, from Africa, from Asia, all across the world. And I asked all the people, you know, what do you guys think of Americans in our action on climate change? And basically the consensus of the group is, you know, why aren't you guys taking responsibility for your actions? Mm-hmm. You're the primary historical cause of the CO2 emissions. And particularly us in Africa, we are suffering the consequences of actions you're taking, and you're still not – the United States is the only country that has not signed the Kyoto Protocol. I think Canada has since backed off. But why are you even taking responsibility by admitting what you've done and taking responsibility for it? And I didn't have a good answer for him, frankly.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait to hear more about that because I have to take another break. We have many calls. We'll take those when we come back. We are talking about climate change. My guests in studio are Jack Fishman, professor with the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at St. Louis University. Brian Ettling is with us, along with Larry Lazar, co-founders of Climate Reality St. Louis. We'll continue this conversation, take more of your calls when we come back. Hello again. Welcome back to our discussion on climate change. Gentlemen, we had on this program a couple of weeks ago and a journalist author by the name of Mackenzie Funk, who has written a book called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. Are you familiar with that, any of you? Well, let me just synopsize very briefly what he was saying. There are an awful lot of people around the world who are profiting and will profit greatly because of the global warming situation. I mean, there are desalination inventions are yet to be made and are being made. There are all sorts of things going on with regard to taking advantage, in a sense, of this problem. it seems to me when we start talking about solutions that this is an issue that will have to be dealt with. There's some big money out there destined to make money on the problem. Jack, your thoughts on that?
There's always economic considerations when you're doing these things, but you have to look at long-term versus short-term benefits. And yes, it may not be beneficial to switch over to non-fossil fuel in the short term, but you know, as Jim Hansen, who's been a leading proponent of global change, has stated, you know, what are we leaving our next generations, our grandchildren? Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to be most cognizant of as we think about how we can improve the world climate-wise. And we're sort of beyond the point, I believe, where we're going to get back to pre-industrial concentrations and temperatures, but we have to make some progress so things don't get considerably worse. So I honestly just don't know how to answer that question, but we have to look at the long-term benefits of reducing carbon emissions. I draw the analogy to using seatbelts. It was very inconvenient when we first had to wear these in the 60s, but eventually we wouldn't think about not wearing seatbelts now for our own safety, and that's sort of how you have to treat the climate problem.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, if I can jump in here too, I stumbled across two articles last summer. One was from Forbes magazine, and the other was from Goldman Sachs, one of their investment reports, and they're telling their investors that coal is not as profitable as it used to be, and fossil fuel. So if you're looking at investments now, it's actually getting more profitable as investors to invest in renewables. And in 2010, for instance, worldwide there was more money put into renewables than fossil fuel. So if you're a portfolio manager or even an average investor looking at your long-term investment, we're going into, as Jack says, we are transitioning to that, like it or not.
But a lot of the work being done on these alternative sources, Larry, is being done by other countries. And that is something that a lot of people here wonder about. For instance, we talk about long-term, short-term. We have the United Nations report comes out and saying we have to do something by 2050. Well, that sounds long-term to most of us. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if we can wait another 30, 40 years, what's the big deal?
We can't wait. you're right. Other countries are taking action. Germany is kicking our butt. China is kicking our butt. We're well behind much of Europe in developing renewables and alternatives, even nuclear. But the other thing about money, since you brought it up, is there's also a conservative case is we want to spend less money, right? So the latest IPCC report is about that. Cost of acting now versus cost of acting in the future. And by far, the most economical, most cost-saving way, the better way to keep money in our pockets now is to take action now and not wait. And that's what the statement I have here is from Ottoman Endifer, the co-chair of the IPCC committee, said, "We cannot afford to lose another decade. If we lose another decade, it becomes extremely costly to achieve climate stabilization. The longer we wait, the harder and more expensive it gets."
Mm-hmm. Sure. I have a note here. It says, if we can develop technology to combat global warming, does it, in a way, act as an excuse to avoid changing behavior, which is something which would be part of the solution? Thoughts? Brian? You're nodding, but you're not saying anything.
Well, the thing about taking action on climate change is that it reduces pollution. We should want to be doing that. And also it fosters energy independence. I mean, we still get close to half of our energy from other parts of the world, many areas that don't like us. Here in St. Louis, for instance, we get upwards of 85% of our energy from coal. And let's think about that for a moment, because the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the end of December, on December 31st of 2012, an article about St. Louis has twice the national average of asthma. And what causes asthma is dirty air. And one of the leading causes of dirty air is coal. We have four coal plants in this area that are not regulated. And we pay for coal with our health care costs in this area. So, yes, we have cheap electric rates, but our health care costs. So by switching to renewable energy, it's going to reduce pollution and make us healthier citizens. All the solutions do create a healthier economy, a healthier, stronger, and helps us out as citizens, especially helps out our kids, my nieces and nephews. I worry about their health Sam and Bailey and Rachel and Andrew, the dirty air that they have to breathe here in St. Louis. So,
but
yes.
Is the air now worse than it was 50 years ago in St. Louis? It was darkness at noon because there was so much pollution in the atmosphere that it literally got dark.
Yeah, that I can answer that because that's been my research for 40 years. And indeed, the air in St. Louis is cleaner than it was before the implementation of air pollution controls. But what we're finding is that the air globally is getting dirtier. And this is my research right now, is that in the background, the atmospheres, we're reaching pollution levels that are definitely impacting crop growth, hurting the forest. Basically, it's not just CO2 that's increasing. There's this other thing that I've been studying for 40-some-odd years, basically surface ozone, whereby levels now have probably tripled since the beginning of the 20th century. And we're approaching concentrations now that are above the levels at which you can actually see damage to plants. And we have a project in front of the planetarium called the St. Louis Ozone Garden, where when things are going to be in bloom in July and August, you can actually see the damage that is created by this relatively cleaner air compared to what it was in St. Louis. But yet these cleaner levels are now more ubiquitous. So we're actually seeing a decrease in crop yield. We did a study and published a paper in 2010 where you could actually see the impact of the background concentrations of ozone having about a 10% impact on the decrease of yield of a soybean crop. Okay, soybean crop in the U.S. is over $40 billion a year industry. If you impact its yield by just a couple percent, you're talking about $1 billion or more cost to farmers just for soybeans. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the air locally is getting cleaner. The air globally is getting dirtier. It's an interesting study, and it's complicated, and that's what I do for a living.
Another thing I'd like to add to that is we still have this problem called the evil twin of global warming, and that's ocean acidification. If we did not have climate change at all, if that wasn't a problem, ocean acidification would probably be just as big of a problem. So that tells us because we're changing the chemistry of the ocean, and that's affecting the bottom of the food supply. So when you affect the basis of the food supply, you're affecting the entire food chain. So it's a big problem.
Fodder for another program,
right?
I'm sure, but it certainly is an important problem. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Donovan calling from Litchfield, Illinois. Go ahead, Donovan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, and thanks for taking my call. I don't mean to open the debate wider than it is now, but the thing that I'm an environmental engineer, and the thing that always strikes me in this conversation is why we don't move on regarding the debate, regardless of the accuracy or the degree at which we're moving toward a warmer climate. Why don't we do what's reasonable and work on reducing carbon emissions and reducing the use of non-renewable resources? Obviously, we had to do that someday. The reason coal is more expensive is it's harder to dig. The reason oil is more expensive is we didn't dig before, and it's harder to get to. It's the writing's on the wall that we've got to go to renewable energy eventually. And if you visit China and see the terrible pollution in the cities in China and the terrible health effects that are actually occurring but aren't talked much about, the reason the Chinese are so into renewable resources is they see the writing on the wall. They know it has to happen. It's not because they're all lefty and more green than us. It's because they see the need, and we all should see the need. We know that there's a huge health effect on the general population with carbon, and engineers work like heck to try to reduce the amount of carbon from the coal plants. We need to keep on burning coal until we can make this transition, so we need to keep on designing bag houses and electrostatic precipitators. But those are just temporary solutions.
Thank you so much for the call. The reality is that we're talking about finite resources, that ultimately one day we're going to run out of all this stuff, and then we're going to have to find something else to do. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, if I can respond to that, if you're concerned about climate change or if you're not concerned about climate change, one of the best things you can do for your wallet is to get a home energy audit. You know, and Sierra Club has been doing great work on this, as well as Ameren. They have actually been partnering on this. And they say that I think Americans worldwide, we could reduce up to a third of our energy by energy efficiency, and you would save a lot of money in the process. there too. So even if you don't accept climate change, this is a great solution looking into energy efficiency. So it's not necessarily buying a Prius or putting solar panels on your house. One of the first things you can do is look in areas where your insulation's not working very well, where there's leaks in your house in your heating and cooling system. If you can fix those things and learn how to use your energy more efficiently, we can easily eliminate a whole coal plant here in St. Louis.
What else can we do?
Well, having just moved back here a couple of years ago and living in a community that was very highly oriented toward recycling, I was amazed in St. Louis area how relatively little amounts of trash, for lack of a better word, is recycled. We had a program back in Virginia, a relatively small city, whereby we had to pay for throwing away trash, but if we could recycle it, it was for free. It was an amazing program. A lot of people had to buy into it, but basically if we start doing what they do, which is pay by the bag, mm-hmm. or pay by the amount of trash you throw away, that might change your mindset, hit you in the wallet a little bit. But the whole mindset in southeastern Virginia where we were was considerably different than what I see here in St. Louis. So we talked about this earlier, about people's attitudes have to change. And, I can't judge. I've only been here a couple of years. But certainly it was not like in other parts of the country that I've lived in.
Larry, isn't this a drop in the bucket? We're talking about energy audits and we're talking about recycling. I mean, and we're talking about China that has a dark sky every day. It's really a drop in the bucket.
This is a systemic problem, and systemic problems require systemic solutions. Mm-hmm. And, yes, every bit helps the insulation. Mm-hmm. I do have a Prius, and I get 50 miles a gallon. So that's a little bit of my contribution. But we'll require a societal solution for this. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need to put pressure on our politicians. We need to speak to our neighbors, speak to our leaders in our communities, our religious leaders, anyone who has influence in our societies.
So what are we talking about? The carbon tax, which has been talked about, removing subsidies from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing that we must
do? That's one. That's
yes.
One. The other one is regulation, EPA regulation, to support our governor, support the NRDC, the National Resource Defense Council, on installing higher, tougher regulations on coal emissions and other emissions around the country, mm-hmm. and along with the carbon tax, because we have to have a price on carbon, so to put the market at work in solving this problem.
Mm-hmm. If I can add to this, Patrick Gonzalez, he's a climate scientist for the National Park Service. He said that there's a million different actions that got us into this climate change situation, and there's a million different things that we can get to do out of it. And so looking for a big picture, if you're looking for one big picture thing, I really encourage our listeners to join a group. And the best group I know that's taking action on this is Citizens Climate Lobby. And we have a group here in St. Louis that's being led by myself and Carol Brayford. And what they're doing is there's 170 chapters of those across the country. They're teaching individuals how to approach your member of Congress and how to approach the media as far as how do we get a carbon fee and dividend passed. And they've been wonders for me, too, helping me get – I have an op-ed published on Earth Day on this here, too. So I would actually encourage our listeners to look up a Citizens Climate Lobby and join us for our next meeting, which will be on the first Saturday in May.
All right. You got your commercial in.
I have another one.
Go ahead.
Well, the other thing is to get informed. And Brian mentioned some of the websites, but I also want to plug our meetup group. If you go to meetup.com, type in climate, you'll find us. And we're having a meeting Sunday, April 27th. It's about debunking climate misinformation. We have a professor from the East Coast calling in who's been in the front lines of climate communication. He's going to tell us some of the psychological reasons and how to confront misinformation. And this Thursday, we'll be in Union, Missouri. We're going to East Central College. Brian, myself, and a few others are going to Union, Missouri. We're giving a presentation there on climate change, and we would encourage you to come. 7 o'clock in Union.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I have that in my notes here, and I had forgotten it. But 7 o'clock, East Central College in Union, Missouri for this. About a minute left. A final thought, Jack, do you just want to leave us with a word?
Since coming back to St. Louis, I've seen what Larry and Brian have done here, and that's what it's going to take. It's going to take this sort of grassroots mm-hmm. effort, I think, to make the people better aware of what's going on.
Yeah. Final thought from you, gentlemen, very quickly.
Yeah, I'll add to this. This is something, a quote that I came up with, and hopefully I'll be quoted on this long after I'm gone. Each and every one of us can change the world, and we do this by the way we vote, the products we buy, and the attitudes we share with each other. And we really appreciate you having us on here today, Don Marsh.
An important subject. And finally, Larry, very quickly.
Climate change is real. It's us. It's now. Science and industry agree, and we have to act. We have to act now.
And here's a final word from Mary Lee, and an email says, global warming or climate change, whatever you call it, the best thing the common man can do, is easy for many, if not most of us, is to plant trees, lots of trees. And, of course, that's just one of the many things that have to be done to change the situation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Climate change, our subject. We have Jack Fishman from St. Louis University here with us, Brian Etling and Larry Lazar from Climate Reality St. Louis. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks again, Don.
Thank you.
We'll be hearing from you again, I'm sure. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the ongoing volatile situation in Ukraine with a local perspective. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.